Hello and welcome to Provox, a podcast from the Queen's College, Oxford. I'm delighted today to be joined by Professor Emma Slack, who is not only a fellow of Queen's College, but also the Barclay Williams Professor of Molecular Mucosal Immunology. Have I got that right? Yes, I have, at the University of Oxford. So, Emma, welcome. It's fantastic to have you here. And I want to spend most of the next half hour or so talking about your incredibly interesting research, and you can probably explain what molecular mucosal immunology is at some point through this. But perhaps you could just start by, and you've had an amazing career. I mean, you've worked in all sorts of places, and you continue actually to split your time between Oxford and Zurich in a way that I find mind-boggling. And getting to and fro London once a week is pretty difficult, but living in two places, two countries, and flying in between all the time must be pretty hard work. But let's come on to that in a minute. All scientists started somewhere. How did you start? Where did the desire to do what you're doing come from?
So I was one of those kids who from the age of about sort of seven had decided I wanted to be a scientist.
Oh,
so I was sort of one of these, I'd always took my toys apart and some irritating childhood behaviour. And I was the daughter of a country GP growing up, in it long enough ago that we used to get taken round, particularly for the palliative care visits, by my dad. He'd take his two little daughters to go and cheer people up, which you wouldn't be allowed to do these days for very good infection control reasons. But it was always, from very early in, I knew you had this thing called the immune system, and I was being taken to visit these terminally ill people. Primary school age.
Wow.
And it was always very surprising to me that your immune system didn't know what to do. You know, that you had this system that was there, it was meant to be protecting you against things, and yet people were still dying of cancer.
You were
or
thinking
infections.
About this at primary
so
school.
So I'd started thinking about this very, very early on. And then I got into nuclear physics, as many kids, the really exciting stuff, of course, is physics, right?
I like this. Like many kids do, I got into nuclear physics.
Absolutely true. And actually, up till about sort of GCSEs, I was thinking I was going to go into physics. And I had a wonderful, wonderful science teacher at school, called Mrs. Chisholm, who managed to make everything very exciting and very relevant, and you had this real feeling of being involved in the edges of reality, which was fantastic. And then for A levels, I had a different physics teacher, who I won't name.
He wasn't so good.
who had a teaching method involved repeating things a lot. At which point, I decided I was going to be a biologist. So here we are, and I got back into the immune system question, right towards the end of school, talking to colleagues of my parents who were doctors, went off and studied natural sciences.
So you
and
didn't
pathology.
Think, you didn't think of doing medicine as the children of many, many doctors
No. So I definitely didn't want to do medicine. I'd seen a lot of it. Also, there's a lot of patients showing up at the house. And I was very much interested in the sort of global interactions. What could we do to improve health? At a sort of worldwide kind of level, I was definitely less interested in the sort of individual, really hard work, day to day, sometimes a bit thankless work that doctors, it's a really hard job being a doctor. I was very keen to be a scientist.
Excellent. And so you did natural sciences at Cambridge, and it's amazing. You started off wanting to work on the immune system. Was that something you could do as part of the undergraduate degree?
So not until the third year. So I kept interested in it. You can always read. I think the good thing for me for the Cambridge degree was that it was very broad. So I did a lot of maths and chemistry in the first year, which at the time you think, I'm never going to use maths and chemistry. I want to be a biologist. And definitely now that's the part of my degree I use most.
That's interesting.
Right? Those are the bits and pieces that I still use undergraduate level chemistry and maths because there's a lot of that in biology, whereas a lot of the biology I learned has since been renewed and reinterpreted and has
so
moved
math,
on, right?
Maths
so,
and chemistry has moved on less than
definitely,
biology.
Well, I mean, that level of maths and chemistry has.
So, yeah. And how are you using the maths? Because you're modelling things.
We do quite a lot of modelling, yep. We work in the intestine. It's a very dynamic system. It's very difficult to approach from a pure logic point of view because everything is happening at the same time.
So tell us a bit about what you're doing. I mean, I'm going to read it out again. Molecular mucosal immunology. I mean, what is that?
Right. So mucosal immunology is really studying the immune system at body surfaces, right? So the way that your immune system works in your blood and in your spleen and in your heart is fundamentally different from the problems your immune system has to deal with where you're coming into direct contact with the outside world. So you can sort of think of it as, you know, sort of deeply in your spleen, a bit like trying to police Buckingham Palace, right? So generally speaking, there should only be the royal family there, and if anybody else gets in, it's, you know, it's quite easy to recognise them, and it's very clear they've got to leave.
Right. Okay. And
similar thing, you know, microbes in your spleen. There shouldn't be any microbes in your spleen. If the microbes show up in your spleen, you've got to get rid of them as quickly as possible. If there's a bit of collateral damage, that's acceptable because you've got to get rid of microbes or growing in your heart tissue, for example. Whereas at your body surfaces are most profoundly in the gut, which is where we work. You actually have more microbes than you have human cells in your entire body. It's roughly 50% microbe in terms of composition, every human is. And some of those microbes are genuinely beneficial, right? They do things like they make vitamin K, for example. So without your gut microbes, your blood wouldn't clot, which is why we give vitamin K to neonatal babies, right? Because they don't have the right bacteria yet to make sufficient vitamin K. They also help you digest your food. But at the same time, both of us sitting here in this room are probably carrying some bacteria in our intestine that if they got into our bloodstream, they would kill us.
Okay.
And yet they don't, right? We're blissfully unaware of this. And the reason they don't is because you have a pretty active immune response going on continuously at all your body surfaces that makes all these things stay in the right place. And they don't grow too abundant and they don't invade elsewhere. And of course, as soon as you have a defect with the immune system, or you know, are in hospital for some sort of procedure that results in immunosuppression, those things can overgrow, they can spread, and that's where we see things like E. coli-driven sepsis in adults. Those bacteria can also spread during
birth. So E. coli-driven sepsis, how does that relate to what we're talking about in the gut?
In the gut. So these would be bacteria that you have in your intestine. Right. They're fine, not a problem as long as you're healthy, right? But then something else happens. They spread from your intestine into the deeper tissues, sometimes via the urogenital tract, into the blood, and then cause systemic infections.
So you're studying specifically the relationship between the sort of microbiome in the gut and people's immune systems, is that right?
Exactly. And what we're trying to work on is how much your immune system can actually control what is colonizing in that environment, and whether we can actually use that.
So your body's immune system is having some control over what's actually in the gut. Right?
Okay. It has some control. Your gut content is topologically outside of you. And so most of your immune system is in the tissues, is in the blood, is in the cells. So we have only very few mechanisms that really get secreted out into that environment.
So just to be clear, you're looking at the relationship with sort of immune to gut rather than the effect of the gut biome on the immune system.
Exactly.
Much more
in the other direction.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
We have to consider it a little bit the other way because it's all part of the same system. But what we're really interested in is how you can activate the immune system via the intestine in order, for example, if you know somebody's going for a bone marrow transplant, you could give them a type of vaccination that would get rid of the particular colonizing species that we know cause invasive infections post-transplant, for example.
I see.
Because if the bacteria aren't there in the first place, then you have to worry, right? They're not going to cause anything else.
And it's fair to say, is it that, I mean, it's not just in what you're doing. Actually, I mean, one of your colleagues at Queen's, Jane Meller, is also working on sort of gut biome, but in a different kind of different kind of way. Is it broadly true that people are seeing this? The creepy crawlies in the gut are increasingly seen as really, really important to our overall health.
Yeah, Yeah, so this is, they're seen as important, but we still have a pretty poor understanding of the mechanisms by which that's true. So what we're good at these days is mapping which microbes are present where and when. We have next generation sequencing. It's very high throughput techniques that gives us lots of data. Mm-hmm. And that's great, but it's a little bit like getting the names of everybody who lives in London, right? And trying to go from that to working out, you know,
which one's doing
what's
yeah.
what's good and what's bad and what's problem is actually very difficult. And some of it is definitely that these microbes have an enormously higher metabolic capacity than we do.
What does that mean?
Which means, you know, you have around 30,000 unique genes in your human genome. The bacteria in your intestine have millions and millions and millions of unique genes.
Wow.
And that means if you take, for example, a drug, we can pretty quickly, you know, in vitro very well work out what your human metabolism is going to do to that compound. But we have a very poor handle on what the microbes do with that compound. There's a lot of research going on now in pharmacology to try and build gut microbiome into pharmacological models, because it probably, or it seems to explain quite a lot of variation in responses between people for different drugs, because they have a bacteria that metabolizes a compound in a particular way or not.
So how much variation is there between us in what's going on in our guts?
It depends how closely you look. So if you look at the phyla level, and just to kind of explain how zoomed out that is, right? Our human phylum is vertebrates.
Okay, so that's quite high level.
So we're quite high level. If we look at the phylum level, roughly all most warm-blooded normal mammals have a similar distribution of phyla.
So phyla is a sort of very high-level classification of different
families
bacteria.
Families of bacteria, yeah. So that's okay. That's quite
How
similar.
How many phyla of bacteria are there?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, in total, huge, huge numbers. Right? Within, very, very hard to define, because it depends exactly on how
many. And within each phylum, there's also huge, within each phylum,
yep.
And huge numbers of phylums.
Yes.
Phyla.
Yeah, and the bacterial phyla differ from each other more than you differ from a mushroom, right? Because those things
okay,
are
all right. I'll take
evolutionarily,
that.
These are things that diverged much, much longer ago than anything with anything eukaryotic.
So to us, to an ignorant person like me, they're all sort of the same. They're all tiny. They're all unicellular, aren't they?
All bacteria, well, pretty much all bacteria behave as unicellular organisms.
And,
and
there are billions of different kinds by the sound of it.
There are, and they are very diverse despite being very small. Yes.
This is
sometimes surprising how different these things can be, but that means they also make very different relationships with us. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Hence this whole range from beneficial
to
really pathogenic.
So at the phyla level, we've all got fairly
phyla
similar.
Phyla level, all pretty similar. If you start to get down to looking at what species I have and what species you have, there's possibly no overlap at all.
Oh, golly.
Right?
Okay.
So at the species level, we're pretty diverse.
Does that change over your lifetime, or are you pretty much, you've got what you've got?
And it depends on the species. So there are some groups of species that you seem to pick up very early and you keep for the whole, pretty much as long as we've tracked it. Next generation sequencing came in 2009, so I can't say whole lifetimes yet, right? We haven't had that much. But from what we see, you see some of them extremely stable over decades. Some others, so E. coli being one of the prime examples, you seem to exchange your E. coli every 6 months or so, on average. So it's very common, for example, if you were to travel to Southeast Asia, the majority of people traveling to Southeast Asia come home colonized by extended spectrum beta-lactamase resistant E. coli, because these are very prevalent in that region of the world. And if we track that over time, within about 3 months, most of those people have spontaneously got rid of that strain again.
Okay.
So it's these. Some of it turns over very quickly. Some of it turns over very slowly. Do we know why? No.
How much difference does it make to my health as against your health that I've got a different set of bacteria in my stomach?
$1 million question. we would love to know that. What we have some information on is what is a really unhealthy microbiome. Right, so at that end of the spectrum, the example I mentioned earlier of people who've gone through bone marrow transplants sometimes end up with a microbiome that's dominated by effectively one species of bacteria. It's often a vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, which can cause disease. So that's clearly an unhealthy microbiome. At the other end of, you know, what makes this a particularly healthy microbiome, you know, if you've got a 100-meter sprinter who's particularly good, is their gut microbiome a particularly good microbiome for making you faster at running? We don't know that, right?
But does it have an effect on my propensity to put on weight, for example?
Right, so weight gain is a really interesting one. So there was a lot of data. It was one of the early hypes in the microbiome field that that microbiome composition was linked to obesity. And the data looked pretty convincing at the time. It was reanalyzed later, which was all done on individuals in the US. And of course, many people with severe obesity also have type 2 diabetes and are taking a drug called metformin. And actually the entire signature that was linking microbiome composition to obesity was being driven by a metformin-driven change in microbiome composition. So at the moment, the data is not clear that there is really a link between your microbiome composition and putting on weight. We do think there are links between the microbiome composition and activity and appetite control.
Mm-hmm.
So there's clearly, there's good data in animal models that the amount of energy released from dietary fiber by your gut microbiome is compensated into your food intake. So an animal knows that it's got 1,000 extra calories from fermentation from its gut, and therefore it doesn't need to eat the rest of those calories. Again, we don't have a very good idea of how that works. So I think there's still a lot more to do in that field.
It might be true.
More research needed. Something interesting, but it's not as simple as that the bacteria extract more energy and therefore you get fat. It's something much more subtle to do with that, related to how your brain actually regulates your food or doesn't regulate your food intake.
So tell us a little bit more about your current research on the relationship between that microbiome and the immune system.
So what we're really currently working on is these interventions that allow you to engineer a specific species out, or a specific strain of a specific species out of the microbiome without needing to use anything like antibiotics, right? We particularly are trying to find that alternatives to antibiotics for getting rid of bacterial infections. And the way that we've been doing that is by combining vaccines that you swallow. So nothing you need to inject. These are based actually just on dead bacteria. So interestingly, the sort of concentration of bacteria in these things is not very different to what you would find in sort of sourdough bread. So they're very, very safe, very straightforward to administer. And swallowing those vaccines induces a very specific type of antibody response in the intestine that can very selectively bind to the strain you want to target. And when it does that, it generates big clumps out of these bacteria, because antibodies have...
No, I didn't even know I had antibodies in my intestines. I thought they were all in my blood.
so it's very true. Most of them are in your blood, but there is a very specific type of antibody. It's referred to as IgA in humans, that is actively secreted across all your mucosal surfaces.
Okay.
And it's only this one very specific type of antibody. So your immune system really controls what goes out. Most of the antibodies, as you say, stay in your blood. They're interesting. These have always been very interesting to me, because we secrete effectively grams of these things into the gut every day. And that's actually quite a lot.
Grams of which things?
Of these secretory antibodies.
Oh, right. Well,
and they're big proteins. So you lose a lot of protein.
Right.
Secreting the thing. It's quite an expensive thing to do. See, in the modern
so
world,
they're doing something
modern
really
world irrelevant yeah. because we have enough yeah. food, but in yeah. places where protein would have yeah. been actually one yeah. of the
so
challenges.
So it must be doing something really important.
So it must be important, right? Yeah. One would think. And actually, the other evidence that's important is that if you look at the evolution of these antibodies in bony fish, so teleost fish, and also in amphibians, they have secretory antibodies, but they evolved independently of our IgA antibodies. So Animals have seemed to decide that this is a useful system to have. They're functionally very similar,
right.
But they have a different evolutionary trajectory.
So we haven't evolved, ours hasn't evolved because they were in our ancestors, the amphibians.
So, no, exactly. So they diverged earlier than that, but we've all got secretory antibodies. And the sort of intriguing thing about them is that these antibodies you have in your blood connect to all sorts of useful looking killing machinery. Right? So you have cells called macrophages that are very good at eating bacteria and viruses and protozoa. And what these antibodies really do is label bacteria and viruses and protozoa so they get eaten up and disposed of. And that's sort of obviously useful. Right? Whereas the antibodies that you secrete into your gut don't do any of that. They don't seem to link to anything that kills anything. And so for a very long time, we sort of hand waved and said, well, okay, they can neutralize viruses. We know that works, because all you have to be able to do for that is stick to the virus receptor, and if you block it interacting with the cell, you don't get virus infection. That's great. And you can neutralize toxins, same deal. But a lot of bacteria cause disease without secreting toxins. So, and yet we know these antibodies were protective. And so the real trick with these turned out to be that if you have an antibody that can stick things together, it can stick bacteria together into big clumps. And in a sort of test tube-like system, it's not obvious what that's good for. The bacteria swimming around, you have the same number of bacteria in clumps, they're still there, nothing very interesting.
Okay.
But of course, your gut content flows quite rapidly. Right. So you handle about 9 liters of fluid through your intestine on an average day.
Right.
It's about 2 liters from what you eat and drink, and 7 liters of secretions that go out and get reabsorbed. So you have a pretty dramatic flow rate, particularly in the small intestine. And if you aggregate things together, they're actually removed much more efficiently in the flow.
Right.
So just sticking things together, it turns out.
By removed, this is not going
flushed
back
out into
blood,
the toilet.
Flushed out into the toilet. Yeah.
And so you don't need to kill them, right? You simply eliminate them by flushing them through in these big aggregates. And we can use that in order to eliminate these ESBL E. coli, these nasty drug-resistant E. coli, and replace them with a bacterium that is not drug-resistant,
okay.
is not invasive, is not a pathogen.
Oh, I see. So it's about replacing.
So it's really about replacing things right, within this right. sort of ecosystem.
Right. Okay. And I mean, more broadly, you talk about trying to, so this is killing something without using antibiotics. What happens to my, this is probably a very basic question, but when I go to the doctor and they prescribe me antibiotics because I've got an infection of some kind, what does that do to all the bugs in my belly?
Kills them.
The whole lot?
Yeah, so the vast majority, yeah. I mean, it depends a bit on the antibiotic and the dose, but definitely the vast majority of antibiotics will cause 100 to 1,000-fold loss of abundance of gut microbes.
What's the consequence of that for my health?
And I mean, obviously, the reason you've been given the antibiotics is that otherwise you die of a horrible infection.
Well,
so that,
well
that's
possibly, or I've got antibiotics, which I didn't really need. But
oh, yeah,
yes.
if you had them, you didn't need them. That sounds. But antibiotics are great drugs and very important. And if your doctor tells you to take them, you should take them. But the side effect is clearly that you do destroy the gut microbiome with this. And some antibiotics, definitely these sort of third, fourth generation cephalosporins, are associated with Clostridium difficile infection is the typical example. So post-antibiotic diarrheal disease, and really severe, unpleasant
right.
post-antibiotic diarrheal disease, because the microbes themselves normally inhibit that bacteria from growing too much and okay. secreting toxins and making you sick. So that's one of the most obvious consequences that we see, and that's not so unusual.
Right? Where does the microbiome come back from? I mean, if you've killed it all, how does it... It just regrows, right. does it?
I mean, so when I say you killed it all.
These are very basic questions.
This is a perfect question. So there's a numerical aspect to this, that you have 10 to the 13 bacteria in your gut. So if you reduce those by 1,000-fold, you've still got 10 to the 10.
Okay. So there's still
quite a lot to grow back from. But some of it, quite a lot of people have done experiments where they've tracked what happens to your microbiome after an antibiotic treatment, how long it takes to recover. And you see some individuals recover fully within a few weeks. Some individuals, they never recover the same composition afterwards. So you're obviously always exposed to microbes right, from low levels via food, via water, via everything you breathe in. You would expect some of the things not to come back, some things to be replaced.
And I mean, is all of this related to, I mean, a whole series of diseases, like, I mean, whether we're looking at cancer or heart disease or anything like that, I mean, is that all related to what's going on?
So for cancer and heart disease, I'm not sure how convincing the evidence is. For the immune-related diseases, so allergies, right, autoimmune diseases.
So what do we mean by autoimmune diseases?
Things like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis.
And they're autoimmune because they're the immune system attacking the
body. The immune system is attacking you. Right. It was doing something that it shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
Yep. And there is, so for allergies, there's some quite interesting data coming out about microbiome composition in very small children. So during the first 2 to 3 years of life, if you look at the microbiome of children who go on to develop severe allergies, so allergies that we diagnose very early, you see that they have less of particular pathways that produce a compound called butyrate. And we know that this compound butyrate is important for a part of the immune system that generates tolerance. So that allows, you know, your immune system sees a lot of things that it shouldn't react to. It does actually have to learn to not react to them. And we know that there's a microbiome-derived component that really supports that. And if there's not enough of it during early life, it seems that that's one of the things that may predispose to developing allergies later. Not a one-to-one link, right? Still correlative data in humans.
And is there a sense that we think this has changed through generation? Because it seems that more children have these problems now than was the case in the past, and we think that's related to diet, presumably.
So this microbiome, diet, exposure are impossible to pull apart in that equation at the moment, because they all relate to each other, right? If you have a poor diet, you know, I grew up in 1980s, you know, we thought sliced bread was amazing.
My dinners throughout childhood were sort of, you know, chips and sausages. I mean, that's right. My mother just put chips in front of me every single day. That's just what.
And that was what.
And I remember having lunch at school. We went to the canteen. I had baked beans on fried bread.
Right.
That was my lunch.
Yeah.
I think I might be in trouble.
And I seem to remember, not only was it our lunch, but we were in a lot of trouble if we didn't eat it. So. Actually, beans at least have some fibre in them. So
Rather
I think
baked beans,
baked beans, thank goodness. but the British diet in the 80s definitely was not supporting your microbiome and not supporting your immune system development, for sure. And there is data in animals that this compounds over generations, because as fewer and fewer people have a diverse microbiome, there's less and less transmission.
So we transfer between ourselves.
We transfer between ourselves.
We're transferring here. We're sitting about a couple of, you know,
probably not much.
And a half away,
no, yeah. I mean, so if we look at sort of sharing of microbiome species, you see this between people who really live together. So and actually, you also see this between people who live together and their pets.
Ooh.
So there is also an element of actually keeping pets is one of the things that that can diversify your microbiome to some extent.
Diversifying is good.
And we, roughly speaking, think that diversifying is good at the moment. It's clearly a proxy for something else that we haven't understood. I think diversity per se is not the driver of health in this, but maybe you're more likely to have something.
Should I be eating probiotic yogurts and all these things that people try to sell to me?
Gosh, yeah. So probiotics is a tricky field, right? A lot of the probiotic yogurts are only allowed to claim health benefits because they also add vitamin A and vitamin D.
Okay, all right, that's a different issue.
To the product. So there is no proven benefit of a lot of the probiotic yogurts. Okay. Definitely the ones that say support your immune system, they're only allowed to write that because they've also vitamin fortified the product.
Okay, well, I don't eat probiotic yogurts.
What definitely does, there's good data that, you know, if you want to support your microbiome, particularly sort of post-antibiotic treatment, is actually fermented foods. So
wine.
if you ate the sediment at the bottom of the barrel, potentially.
No, okay, right. No, the, not that sort of fermented.
But definitely things like kefir, so more diverse fermented products, fermented vegetables, sauerkraut, kimchi.
Okay.
In parts of the world where they eat those things in large, so particularly, you know, places like Japan, and they eat a lot of fermented products, you see that that has a sort of obvious beneficial effects on microbiome composition.
Okay. I was joking. I presume that drinking alcohol just kills it rather than helps it.
I don't think there's any good evidence that drinking alcohol is of any benefit to your microbiome. No, I'm not sure. Sure anyone's done any studies. You'd have to drink a lot of alcohol for this to really kill.
Well, I mean, it's always worth a try.
there is incidental evidence from lots of N=1 studies from doctors that alcoholics do rather well on enterohemorrhagic E. coli infection.
What does that
potentially
mean?
Because there's so much alcohol that they kill the E. coli. So you'd expect these people to do very badly because they tend to have liver failure, but actually they do surprisingly well, presumably just because they manage to maintain an ethanol level that is actually toxic to the E. coli. but I don't think that's probably not to be encouraged.
Your research is probably going to do us more good.
I think, not the way to go.
I mean, we've talked a lot about the sciences. How do you do this? I don't quite imagine. I mean, you run a lab here. You run one in Zurich as well.
Yeah.
And what does this look like? I mean, what are people actually doing day to day in order to do the research that you're describing?
Good question. So we're quite a big team. So across the two sites, we're about 30 people. And we have a range, one of the real joys of my work is we're a range of different expertise. So everybody from doing sort of synthetic biology to design these types of vaccines, which we're actually giving orally, and there's all sort of interesting logic behind that because it fits your digestive system, right? So if everything you swallow, the risk is it just gets digested, and we want it to get into your immune system. So there's some quite interesting design principles behind this of making vaccines that get to the immune system via the gut. Then we work also in mouse models, so it's still impossible to model this whole.
So you mean with a mouse?
Mice, live mice.
With live mice.
So we do as much as possible with in vitro experiments, but you cannot at the moment, either in a computer or in a test tube, model the complexity of having a functional gut with a functional microbiome and a functional immune system. Mm-hmm. So to really understand this, we're still reliant on being able to use animal models. Then we also do some clinical studies. So we have also some parts of the group interested in collecting samples, sequencing the microbes that are there, looking at the distribution of, are the E. coli that cause infections in Switzerland different to the ones in Oxford, different to the ones in India, different to the ones in Thailand? Because if you're going to make these vaccines effective, you need to be targeting the right thing. All of these people come together and work as a team, so it's really exciting to be part of it and a real privilege to lead these people.
Fantastic.
And generally it works well. It's always complicated. There's a lot of paperwork. that's what I do mainly these days.
And the output, as it were, the outcome. Have you got to the point with anything where you've done human trials, for example?
So we've just grounded a spin-out company actually from the Swiss end of the lab who are moving one vaccine product towards the first in-human clinical trial. It's still a huge amount of work to get from the lab really into a human.
But it's a huge amount of work because you need really strong evidence this is going to be safe and effective before you even
start. Definitely. I mean, the evidence that's fine. We're quite good at that. It's what gets really challenging are the things that are beyond your skill set. So manufacturing is a big thing. What are you going to package it in? How are you going to, can you store it on a shelf for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 10 years? And all of the safety and regulatory paperwork that needs to be done to go with that. For any injected vaccine, it's still a requirement that this needs to be tested in a non-human primate before it goes to humans. Mm-hmm. So setting up collaborations to be able to actually do that in a way that we think is ethically tenable. So all of these things are still challenging.
So what is the specific thing that you're moving forward with there?
And the specific thing we're moving forward there is it's a so-called glycoconjugate vaccine. So similar to the vaccine you get for pneumonia, right? The Streptococcus pneumonia vaccine is also a glycoconjugate. That's not an oral vaccine. It's just an injected intramuscular vaccine. This one will also be an injected intramuscular vaccine aimed at targeting invasive E. coli infections, so pyelonephritis and sepsis.
So this is something you give people.
People who are at high risk of developing invasive infections.
And so how, I mean, I've heard from other people that this, you know, that this is then a really long and expensive process to get from where you've got, you're just sort of, you know, you've got this in the lab, you think it might really be quite effective, but it's going to be a lot of time and a lot of money, even if this is super successful.
Yeah, this is very true. And it's, you know, it's a difficult time also for biotech right now, because a lot of the support for this sort of thing was coming from the US. And that's not coming from the US at the moment.
From US private capital, presumably.
Also from things like NSAID, right? Because a lot of these things are targeted at low and middle income countries.
Oh, I see a lot of this was funded by USAID.
Development. So we never had funding because we were too late for that. But vaccine development actually has been
occurred to me.
Has been affected by this.
Right. Your E. coli vaccine will be most relevant in those low income.
Would be most relevant in those types of environments. So that's a challenge. And of course, then you have to make a vaccine that not only works, but is considered, you know, value for money and that people are actually interested in having. And these days, that's become also a massive communication challenge, because a lot of people have been shouting very loudly that they think vaccines are not safe.
Indeed.
Which, you know, I can have an hour-long conversation about. You know, that's probably a separate podcast, but where the basis of, you know, as with all things, there's a tiny bit of information that has probably sat at the bottom of some of those fears, most of which is really completely unfounded, right? It's a game of sort of broken telephone.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of work to do there outside of the lab, right? Really, you know, we can make the most perfect vaccine we want, but if nobody wants to take it, then that's pointless.
So can you give us a sense of time and money from, you know, getting out of the lab to getting into someone's arm?
So
beyond the trials.
So beyond the trials, okay. So it's easier to estimate to get to the first in human trial. Right. So a first in human trial is really done purely to assess safety. Mm-hmm. And that we're aiming to do within the next 2 to 3 years.
Right.
If that goes through,
so
then
this is 2 to 3 years after you've essentially done the basic scientific research. Yeah.
Yep. If that all goes through, and that the spin out has support from an organisation called Carbex that is developing alternatives to antibiotic treatment, and will, assuming all the milestones are met, support the company through to these phase one clinical trials. It's probably another 10 years beyond that point for a normal vaccine to actually get into the clinic.
Okay.
So, you know, during the pandemic, they showed you can do this faster.
Faster, thankfully.
But a lot of that delay is really administrative time because, you know, there's many things that these clinical safety boards need to evaluate.
Is your hunch that this is over-regulated, or is this stuff that actually needs to happen and actually needs to take 10 years?
I think the regulation is good. It needs to be safe, right? We need public confidence in these things. If we put a few more people on the, you know, set up a few more committees, you could go twice as fast.
Right.
It's a little bit of a cost trade-off, speed cost trade-off there.
Yeah. Was there a particular reason you chose to Switzerland for the spin out rather than the UK?
So it's simply that started before that was work developed in Switzerland and before we were moving to Oxford. I actually think the spin out environment from Oxford is very attractive. There's very good support here. And the company is considering having a UK subsidiary because also the support for clinical translation in the UK is very, very good. It's actually one of the reasons for moving to Oxford.
And clinical translation means?
To be actually able to run the clinical trials. So the UK has very good clinical trial centres.
Right.
We have the Innovate Fund. We have good support, good collaboration between industry and scientists.
So positive.
Really a positive story here.
Right.
And the NHS, right, which is
big.
It's big, is across the whole country, whereas in Switzerland we actually have effectively a privatised medical system.
Yeah. And I mean, what difference does that mean? I mean, one hears lots of horror stories about how difficult the NHS is to work with, even if it is in principle, you know, the world's best customer because it is so big?
I mean, I so far, you know, ask me again in 3 years' time. So far, so good. So far, so positive, I would say. I think the scale of things you can achieve with the NHS is what makes the investment worth it.
I mean, to what extent is, you know, the projects you're working on at the moment, are they going to be, you know, essentially occupy the rest of your life? Are you moving on to new things? I mean, where do you go from here?
So I'm relatively convinced probably we'll still be working on getting these E. coli vaccines working up to the end of my research career. That doesn't mean we're not starting other things. So, and we always have all sorts of projects going on the side in the lab. So our hope is what we've done for E. coli, which is one of the bacteria we understand the most about, right, of all bacteria, that we can expand that then to relatively closely related bacteria. So Klebsiella causes a similar range of diseases, less famous.
I've never
heard of Klebsiella, exactly. Klebsiella is it's relatively close relative of E. coli, which causes a very similar disease spectrum. Okay. But then also to, you know, one of the other things one consider doing, this is as many people around the world work out what it is that makes a healthy microbiome. This is also a tool you can use to very rationally engineer that you want to bring in this one specific species, because this is going to make Paul much healthier than he is now. and we could do this then for the very diverse bacteria that you have in your gut in a very targeted way.
So finally, you've relatively recently moved partly to Oxford. I mean, what brought you here? And to live this, as I said right at the beginning, this incredibly difficult life, it seems to me, of doing work in Oxford and in Zurich. And I suppose I should also ask, and where does Queen's College fit into all of that?
Yeah. So I mean, it's also a massive privilege, right, to be able to live across two countries. The real benefit is that we get to access all of the expertise in both places. And science is really an international activity. Like, we're not siloed. We always have worked across borders. And the more brains, the better. The reason I applied, there were many reasons that I applied for the job in Oxford. One was simply that, you know, an Oxford senior professorship in molecular immunology came up, and I read the advert and thought, I could do that. That sounds like the sort of thing we do.
That was true. And
you know, in many ways, I applied sort of on the off chance, thinking they'll never give me an Oxford professorship. Surely not. And was then very flattered when they offered it to me. The other thing that was a big drive here was really this clinical translation aspect, that the infrastructure, the support, the types of things you can do in the UK system are orders of magnitude bigger and better than what can be achieved in the Swiss medical systems. And we're sort of just getting ourselves set up to really take advantage of that. And Queen's is great. I didn't really understand, I think, what I was letting myself in for with a professorial fellowship. Nobody had explained really what a professorial fellowship was, I think. I assumed it would be all sorts of teaching, and it turned out when I arrived, we really just expect you to eat dinner. And I was,
it is a central part.
It took me a long time to work out what this is. What the role is, but actually it's, you know, particularly because I'm often sort of alone traveling to Oxford, it's a real family from home, and also an incredibly inspiring environment. So, you know, I interact with colleagues, I've made friends who are experts in Egyptology, in philosophy, in all sorts of, a lot of material scientists, some of whom, you know, we have actually useful discussions about that have become incorporated into my research, and I've also, you know, started also to work with the students since discovering that there are things I can. So I do a lot of college advisee work, which I enjoy, and so I feel like I'm doing slightly more than just eating dinner, which is is a good.
That's wonderful. I sometimes wonder whether I'm doing much more than eating dinner, I have to say. But I think we probably need to draw that to a close. I mean, I could honestly, do this for hours because it's so fascinating. So Emma Slack, just brilliant, just really interesting, really inspiring. I think anyone who's listening to this will agree, and I hope anyone who's thinking of careers in science really thinks about that very seriously, particularly if they were thinking about it from the age of six. But Emma,
it's fine to start later.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.